What's good, y'all? Welcome to Conversation Piece with Patrick Armstrong. I am the titular Patrick, and this is a show where we talk about the missing pieces of the conversations we're already having. Shout out to our returning listeners, and a high five and hello to everybody joining us for the very first time. I appreciate y'all being here in 2024, the year of the nap. My guest today is a purpose-driven, action-oriented servant leader and proud product of Indianapolis, Indiana. He's a graduate of the IU McKinney School of Law, lecturer in entrepreneurship and innovation at Butler University, and the founder of Murdoch LLC, a company that's dedicated to building entrepreneurial champions through storytelling. He's also committed to becoming the greatest powerpreneur the world has ever seen. It is my honor and privilege to welcome Anthony Murdoch II to the show. Mr. Murdoch, thank you for coming by.
That was a hell of an intro.
I appreciate that.
No, that's a hell of an introduction, man. I appreciate you for the space and for the introduction, man, for real.
Absolutely. It is, I say, always it's an honor and privilege. It is really an honor and privilege. I've been following you for a little bit now, especially as I try to make moves here in Indianapolis and, and connect with the right people, and literally inspiring me here on the way to the studio today, giving me chills on some stuff. We'll get into it. But I gave you this introduction, and for folks who may not know who you are, do you mind just sharing a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, you really hit it on the head. But man, I was born and raised in the church. You know what I'm saying? I'm blessed by the best. And I'm just going every day trying to be the best steward I can be over what God has blessed me with. You know, there's so many people who I grew up with, who I grew up around, that haven't been blessed to see what it is I saw. And it's not because I'm any smarter or any better. It's just, man, I'm blessed. You know, I'm trying to play the cards I was dealt as best as I can. And it's just a blessing to be in the game.
100%.
You know what I'm saying? Right now, I'm starting. And in different parts of players' careers, you see where I'm going?
Yep.
You know, you go to some teams and you a starter.
Yep.
Other teams, you on the bench. Sometimes you get cut. And right now, I'm starting in the world's largest small city. Mm. You know, leading a movement in a space where the storytelling capital of the world. And Doc, that's a privilege. It comes with power. And like I said, just trying to do the best I can with what I got.
I love that.
Thanks,
storytelling capital of the world.
Yes,
that's
sir.
Dope. I haven't heard that. We've been getting a lot of new descriptions of Indy recently on the show, and I'm here for all of them.
Yeah.
Because as I'm, you know, start to find my space, start to really enmesh myself in the community, it's really, really wonderful to come across all of these different definitions of what it means to be here in the city. So I appreciate that. excuse me. You got away with words. And I was going to get in, we're going to get into it a little bit later, but like, you're so eloquent. You clearly an orator or orator, however you want to pronounce it. Where did you find the passion for speaking? You grew up in the church.
For sure.
I'm assuming it might start there, but when did that really start to develop for you?
No, that's good, bro. And I be trying to pinpoint like where it came from. I think as a kid, like a lot of us, you know, we have formative childhood experiences. So born and raised in the church. But I never was in church mesmerized by what the pastor was saying.
Okay.
Or the way in which the pastor was teaching themselves. Where it probably came from, bro, was when I got to college and I started to get a better understanding of what Black history meant right now.
Okay.
You know, it's one thing when you're surrounded by your own people, that becomes normal. But when you're one of the only ones, then it gets interesting. And man, and we're going to get a little bit deep for a second, but my experience with whiteness, I didn't even realize how much that shaped how I saw Blackness.
Mm.
To a point where I'm in this journey of decentering whiteness as I talk so much about liberation for Black people. Because I didn't even know how much white people had to do with me being proud of being Black.
Mm.
So when you talk about the desire to speak and put words together, that came because in college, I needed to read James Baldwin. I needed to listen to Malcolm X. I needed to study Dr. King. I needed to become proximal to Kwame Ture and Angela Davis and Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells. These are people who and Phyllis Wheatley and Alice Walker. And, you know, the names keep going because these are people who took words and made words powerful because they told amazing stories.
Yeah.
And some of them never opened their mouth. They just wrote things down. But God bless him with a voice. And in the age of socials, right? And everybody named Mama, and you know this now because you actually have a high quality podcast, but everybody's trying to put their voice in something to share with people, but many people don't have things to say.
Sure.
And man, when I got to college, bro, and I started experiencing so much pushback to my identity, It made me find my voice, land on my plane. And so then what it did, Doc, is it gave me, it was a healing process. Because as a child, I wasn't taught to speak up. So now, being an adult and given a platform to speak, there's this reparation to the trauma that a child experienced in social environments. Yep. So, man, it's a lot of things at once. And so it didn't necessarily come from the church, even though a lot of people say I sound like a preacher, which I hate because I ain't no preacher. But in the same token, I understand what they mean by that. And, man, sure. just trying to use my voice as best I can with what I got, man.
I appreciate you sharing all that, and I really resonate with a lot of it, particularly this idea of decentering whiteness in your own life and how you understand yourself as a Black person, yourself in the Black community, Black culture. I'm doing the same thing, and I've been on a similar journey over the last 3 years as an Asian and Asian American.
I got
person.
A hell of a lot of respect for it too, bro.
I appreciate it. Well, because I was adopted by a white family, grew up in rural Indiana. Mm-hmm. I only knew whiteness, and through that understanding of the world, I came to reject deeply my Asian identity. And even when I got to college, I was still navigating the world that way because of that deep rejection. Yeah. And it would take 3 decades for me to start to unpack that and find my voice and figure out, oh, this is what I can do, why my story is important. And not only the importance of telling it, but the privilege of being able to do so after I meet other people who maybe don't find this way to be able to share and have something to say or know that they have something to say.
Can I lean into that just real quick?
Absolutely.
Man, because I'm loving this. And there's so many people. This is a hot button topic right now.
Yes.
But seldom do people have a vocabulary, scratch eloquent or articulate. Because even those, we can deconstruct what those words really mean.
Exactly.
But seldom do people have a vocabulary to articulate how they feel. Hip-hop did that for me. Mm. Like when I met hip-hop my sophomore year of high school, knew about it. Like we crossed each other in the hallway before, but we met my sophomore year. We developed a relationship really for real when I was in college. It gave me a vocabulary.
Sure.
And I started learning about how hip hop English was like a derivative of English, but not in because of English we have hip hop, but because of English, hip hop is this necessary.
Sure.
Why am I bringing it up to you? Seldom do you have a messenger, okay? Like scratch orator, scratch.
Right.
A messenger who has not gone through, especially in this Eurocentric, white supremacist, capitalistic, you know, cishet context, right? Western, that's what I say, Western context,
yes.
That has not gone through a reimagination, a rediscovery. Seldom.
Yeah.
Like seldom has someone woken up and been like, no, I was like this since I was born. I've always been this proud of who I am. No. Oftentimes these messengers, brother, were brought up or were deeply immersed in a context that was not their own. And through that trauma, and they may not have named it as trauma from the jump.
Right.
But through reflection, they named it as trauma. They've experienced, oh my God, I have a message people need to articulate. And I want to encourage you with that. Right. When you talk about, and I'm not saying you need my encouragement, but to meet you there.
Yeah.
Like most of us did not grow up in environments where we were affirmed, our identity was not affirmed
exactly.
from the jump. So I just, and a lot of people think that's the case. They think we was raised and we were always as proud to be who we were. And it's like a lot of this came from shame.
Right. Well, it's like you, for me, like you talk about the trauma and we don't name it as trauma. Adoption specifically, just in my experience, is never named as trauma. It's named as a positive experience for all people.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about the cultural loss, the communal loss, of language, of identity.
Come on, bro.
And or describing it as shameful.
Mm.
Even though you could have, like myself, a positive adoption experience
of course.
With your family.
Of course.
You still, even myself, develop that shame of who I was. And I love what you said about like after the rediscovery, you know that you were like always been proud about it. It wasn't until that rediscovery that I actually saw pride, but it really wasn't until 2-3 years down the line that I found not just acceptance of those pieces of myself, but love.
Mm.
And I've been going through this journey of understanding the difference between acceptance and love, self-love, and moving into this space of like, oh, I really love myself. And not only this version of me, but that young version of me too, who was struggling, who was going through it at that time. So I really appreciate you naming all these things because it is hot button, especially since 2020. Like, and I, as an adoptee, I came out in terms of finding my voice with a lot of other people in that community who are doing something similar. But like you said, there's not a lot of people who end up continuing on that journey, whether they had the opportunity or not.
Yeah,
and it's like,
I've just happened to pursue it in a way that provides a platform to hopefully elevate people into that space.
And man, that's why loving yourself is a revolutionary action. And you work that revolution. And that, you can't make this stuff up, bro, but is, man. And the thing about a revolution is it's like a ripple.
Yeah.
A revolution is like, because you can't control it. And it rises from the bottom. Because once that first plop, you can't stop them waves that come after.
No.
And that's the same thing with loving yourself, Doc.
100%. And it's like, it's wild to think about the journey of coming to consciousness about my identity and about the life that I live. That's the language that I've found to describe this experience, is like trying to reach that point of love. Mm. But the wild thing is, now that I hear you talk about it, it's like, okay, that love was always there. Mm. It was really just uncovering and digging up the roots and planting it within a foundation of all of that respect, of acceptance, of reclamation, whatever that might be with the identity. And now I'm like, I just had therapy today, so I'm feeling real good about this. Thank you for that. And like you said, the affirmation is so important.
Yes, sir.
Because a lot of us don't grow up with affirmation in any realm. And particularly for people of the global majority, they experience
love that language. Love that language.
We experience this idea of there's only certain routes you can go, the only certain ways you can experience and navigate life, because that's coming from a place of trauma from our ancestors who are like, this is the only way we can survive Eurocentric, white-centric world.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And this is good. No, I'm just, and again, I know we got the questions to get to.
No, you good.
But even words like global majority or the global South.
Yeah.
Or like there's these words. And again, I'm not talking about eloquence or the ability to articulate. But this is why, and again, in this age of mass production of content, it is still so unfortunate how ignorant people are.
Right.
But here's my theory on that. Speaking specifically to my experience, and never speaking for all Black folks, but I know that a lot of Black folks can relate. Man, we went from being trained not to get water to... then you get these drips of dirty water. And so now your body is getting used to having unhealthy water. Mm. And then you get like the faucet, but then you're positioned to fight over the one drop from the faucet. That still ain't that clean, but it's not as dirty as it used to be.
Yeah.
So now you got a generation of people dealing with dirty water, talking about, y'all got it so good because you got this clean water. When we both is dealing with a drip from a faucet that we don't own, that we got to pay people to get, when we should have never been fighting for water in the first place. Because we created irrigation systems. Mm. But that's a different conversation for a different day. And then in two more generations, bro, now you got people drowning.
Yep.
You've gone from a drop from a faucet to drowning. None of those things are healthy, man.
No.
And that's why when we say that hurt people, it's true. So how do you bring it back to the content? We've gone from it being a crime to be educated to TikTok. From a crime to speaking your truth to... you can create a podcast tomorrow.
Right.
From it being a crime to pick up a newspaper owned by white people. It's a crime to go to the newspaper stand and pick up a majority-owned newspaper. To now, I can start a blog tomorrow. And the things we have to fight to get access to before, we have so much access to it now, but still with so little tools on exactly how to navigate it.
Right.
And so that's why I just deeply appreciate speaking to people who have found a language that suits their experience. Because there are words to articulate. That's why stories are powerful.
Yeah.
Because there are words for our experiences. We just got to go through life to find them and find the right people. So I'm glad to be sharing space with you today.
100%. Just that part of it made me think about, you talk about how systems, the only way we can disrupt and dismantle systems is with other systems. But we have to understand our stories. We have to uplift and give power to those stories and know that we can do those things. And you talk about being in college, like learning and really finding, you know, not only the resistance to your identity, but finding the support and the affirmation in it.
Yes, sir.
And to live into it. And then you end up going to law school, which law is a foundation, a system within itself.
Come on.
What prompted, is that the prompt to get into that field of study in particular?
No, so law school came from seventh grade.
Okay.
Man, by the time it's time to go to law school, I ain't want to go to law school no more. So law school came from, and it's wild. I was at an event the other day and I learned that there was someone else who did this. And I never knew somebody else did this until this event. That's the beauty of community. Mm-hmm. Cause you'll think your experience is solitary,
bro,
or anomalous
100%. Until you just get in.
And it was a black woman who shared the experience. So shout out to black women. My whole point there is when I got home from school in middle school, I would watch the news, CNN. That was what I would watch. And so I would see legislators, political commentators talking about laws. And I came home from school and there was a law being passed in the state of Arizona. It was being considered. It was on the floor. I think of the Florida House. It's like House Bill 1000 something. And basically it's from my seventh grade understanding, it said the police can arrest somebody based on how they look. They can say, you look like you're not from here. So I can take you into custody to question your citizenship. Mm-hmm. I didn't have that language then, but that's what I understood to be on the TV. So I'm like, but didn't Dr. King die? So that we weren't judged by the color of our skin, but the content of our character. How can you tell if someone looks like they're from the States or not from the States? And just because they're not from the States, why can you take them to jail? Like, that didn't make any sense to me.
Right.
And we understand what they were talking about at the time, but anyway, so at that point, I was like, well, shoot, if laws are being used to oppress people, then lawyers, you know, the root of lawyer is law.
Right.
Then lawyers are the ones who are going to free them. So I said, I'm going to go to law school and be a lawyer to stop this stuff from happening to people. And that was from the seventh grade. And I was tied to that. And I was so convicted. Like, I feel like I found purpose in that moment.
Okay.
For someone who was being spoken for in every element of their life. Like, I felt like I was speaking for myself. I had finally found my voice to do something. Like, that was my calling. And so I became zealously committed. And it's funny, I was zealously committed to it. And a couple years before I go to law school, they take zeal out of the purpose of an attorney because mm-hmm. that zeal can be taken out of context and become abusive.
Right.
But anyway, that was why I went to law school, man. And, okay. And then by the time I get there, you know, my junior year of college, I think, is when I'm applying. And I started my first business at that time. I became an alpha at that time. And man, my whole, which is, you know, two completely separate conversations, which we may or may not touch on today. But man, it changed my perspective on it all. And so at that point, law school was like, I said I was going to do it, so I got to do it.
Sure.
But I kind of reinvented my legal experience by the time I got there.
Okay, we'll talk about that. Like going into law school now with a reinvented idea of what you want the law to be or mean for you and how you're going to utilize it.
Boy. So like I said, my junior year of college, I started my first brand with my best friend, Noah Warfield. He was an engineer. And again, I was about to go to law school. Neither one of us had any business background, which is why it's so wild that I'm now a business professor and have a business in a nonprofit in the business ecosystem because I didn't come from any of this, right?
Sure.
But my point was part of what entrepreneurship did for me is it made me question what change actually looked like. And not just change, but sustainable change, right? So I grew up on the civil. The business, as they said, was the silver, right? They were talking about the civil versus the coin.
Yep.
And I had heard about economic empowerment growing up, but entrepreneurship had a negative stigma attached to it growing up. I thought the entrepreneurs were the people who didn't take they didn't take authority well. And I was taught by a disciplinarian that you better follow these daggone rules. There's going to be a painful consequence associated with it. So like entrepreneurship, that's for people who don't know how to do work. Mm. And now look at me. I'm a serial freaking entrepreneur. So I wonder how my childhood self will feel about the way that I am now. But I learned that economic empowerment, learning about capitalism and its accountability mechanism for racism. I was like, well, they dang near did have a point because we can change these laws, but these laws are rooted in interests and these PACs and super PACs, which are run by money. You know, I could be the most oratorical person in the world, but if I ain't got no coins to back up what it is I'm saying, you know, I don't know how far this is going to go. And I've seen too many examples of that. Mm-hmm. So now I'm going to law school. I'm like, dang, I spent all this time, got all this speaking ability trying to change these laws, but I can't be broke and do it. And so now I'm thinking about how am I going to leverage my law degree to put me in spaces to acquire resources to move them forward. Mm. And so, and this is happening, to be honest with you, this is happening at the same time that I'm experiencing the greatest academic challenge ever. Like I'm being invalidated in the classroom in law. It's one thing for school to be hard. It's different for you to be invalidated in the space.
Right. And it's like an actively invalidation against you.
Like, you ain't supposed to be here.
Right.
Like, I had people, professors telling me for the first time, yeah, I don't know if you're going to graduate. Like, we've heard the stories of the rappers, you know, the seventh grade teacher says, you're never going to make it. So then they go to the booth at 9 years old and drop it. You know,
I'm
talking
about. Yeah.
Hey, man, like, I had that when I was in law school. And I'm like, I'll be doggone. I'm going into debt to pay for an education, to learn from people who say I'm never going to be able to graduate. And that was why my Black graduation speech, it was one of my favorite quotes I've ever had in a speech in my life. I said, they told me I wouldn't pass the bar, so I raised the bar. And that was my way of saying, you all told me I couldn't get here. And you're right, I didn't get to where you thought. I got so much further than that.
Yeah.
I did something beyond what you would have ever expected. So at the same time that I'm experiencing academic invalidation, I'm experiencing entrepreneurial affirmation.
Sure.
My business is taking off. And then COVID hit, bro. And for so many people, I ain't got to tell you that PPP, you know, and people still playing off the PPP now. I ain't get none of that. But man, this moment of small business growth and development in a time where especially our community needed some sense of, and I hate the word hope, but some sense of hope or encouragement. Mm. Hey, bro, I'm at the moment.
Yeah.
And so, no, I divested from my academic prowess and invested in my entrepreneurial capabilities. And law school became the ultimate cosign. He's in law school doing this? He's in law school doing, little do they know I ain't going to class. So it just worked out and we made it make sense.
Yeah.
That's being real with you.
I appreciate that. It's like, you know, COVID put everybody in this, you know, you either going to make it or you have to reinvent yourself again, whatever that looks like. And I appreciate you talking about how you had this realization that you have to step into these spaces where the money comes from. Capitalism. Yeah. You have to infiltrate capitalism is what I've been talking about that a lot with in the adoptee space, within the Asian American space. Like we have to go where the money is, even though if you look at the historical or if you look at the context of people who have been fighting against these things, like a Grace Lee Boggs or Yuri Kochiyama, who resist those things.
Yes.
We can take those teachings. We have to get in there where the resource is if we want to continue to pull these things down.
Absolutely.
Systems that dismantle systems.
Come on, Doc.
That we replace them with. And I feel like that is a hard concept for people to understand.
Yes.
Particularly from an abolitionist standpoint.
Come on.
Because it almost runs counter. Wow. Well, it does run counter to the belief of what abolition means.
Let's speak on it.
So what do you, like, I want to hear from you. Like, what is that? What does that mean for us? How do we close that gap? And how have you done it?
Yes.
I'm assuming that's what a powerpreneur
is. You're great. I'm going to tell you right now. You're good at what you do. Some of y'all... Hey, man.
I appreciate that.
Back to the point of end. I'm going to give you three things, Doc. Number one, we cannot continue to inherit the shame and pain that systems we didn't create cause us. Hmm. What do I mean by that? We are in a psychological, emotional, social conundrum where we're trying to balance, rectify. How do I say I want to see liberation for my people? But I'm also trying not to be broke at the same time. Hmm. And I feel bad for it, right?
Right.
Because all the people who I have inspired me to even believe I can be liberated have problematized this thing for the sake of this thing. And I'm having this issue with, well, let's take 18 steps back, brother. We wouldn't have to rectify with this had we not been forcefully exported from our home into someone else. So that's number one.
Yep.
A lot of this pain that we're dealing with of trying to figure this out comes from a problem we did not create.
Right. A root trauma placed upon.
Doc, you hear me? So that's numero uno. Number two, and for me, this is deeply spiritual. We problematize white folks all the time for the savior complex. Mm. I'll be more specific. Black folks problematize non-black people for the savior complex. Sure. It ain't just white people, because whiteness can be perpetuated even by your own kind.
Yes.
But I will also tell you this. Because whiteness can be perpetuated by your own kind, some of us as leaders have a savior complex.
100%.
And we are walking into places attempting to do things we don't have the capacity, capability, or congruency to accomplish. And if we keep walking in thinking, I'm going to figure out how to do this, when ain't nobody figured out how to do this, it's going to add to more pain that came from fighting a system I didn't create. Mm. As a matter of fact, brother, if I'm not being that critical, that's why critical thinking is crucial. June 2024. if I'm not thinking this critically, I'm actually doing the system a service.
Mm.
Because now I'm inheriting a labor.
Right.
Capitalism, come on, Doc. A labor to overproduce and not rest because I'm wrestling with how. And it's not even supposed to work.
Mm.
So that's number two. Number three, people gonna complain regardless.
Yep.
And I think something that's super duper important is, I told you generationally, in three or four generations, we've gone from, within my context, the way that I understand my folks' history, which is my history, which at a certain level is our history,
mm-hmm.
we've gone from no water to drops of dirty water to drowning. Part of what I'm also learning is we've only been exposed to a fraction.
Yo, yeah.
A fraction of liberation. A fraction. You hear me? And even though the fraction, unfortunately, it still does not come from platforms that are purely invested in our liberation.
Mm.
So there's still a little bit of seasoning. Some of it's a lot of seasoning, right?
Yeah.
But some of it's a little bit of seasoning of that system. It's filtering just what our liberatory ancestors had to do to inspire us to be abolitionists, to believe that capitalism could be debunked, to believe that we could live in a decarcerated society, to believe that we can close the racial wealth gap. Even in narratives that encourage us to dream further, still got a little bit of that white supremacy season on it. You picking up what I'm putting down?
Yep.
So letting my plane, that third point is saying, people gonna complain regardless because everybody don't know. And if we're the ones that are leading, it's because we have some level of knowledge. And I'm tired of letting people who don't know tell me about what they don't know and make me feel bad for what I do know.
Mm.
Because I also got to deal with my demons just like you do.
Right.
Your beauty is you can ignore them. Mine, I know they're going to be here regardless.
Right.
And so part of where I get peace, Doc, part of where I get peace is understanding, am I perfect? No, I wasn't built to be. That's the beauty of grace and mercy. That goes back to that spiritual peace.
Yep.
However, I'm a hell of a lot further than 99% of people are ever going to be.
Sure.
And by nature of that growth, I'm doing the best I can with what? With what I got.
Yep.
And I refuse to continue my life of inheriting, of internalizing, of ingesting these messages from the same system I'm seeking to dismantle, even if they're coming from faces that look like mine.
Mm.
Because hurt people are just hurting people. And folks will question my ability to balance black liberation with capitalism when all they do is complain.
Mm.
And if you want to go bar for bar, truth for truth, then let's go. Because I know who I was before, when capitalism, I couldn't even articulate it because of how sick of a system I thought it was. Until I learned that the Black Panther Party was crucial at fundraising.
Mm.
Their ability to provide free breakfast was because they did what? They raised money.
Right.
Because they understood how what? The system worked. We weren't glorifying it. But they had to call a spade a spade.
Exactly.
So that was a long-winded answer, but I try to be practical by giving you three different things.
No, I appreciate it. That could be the whole interview. We could just cut it right there, and people can walk away with some lessons. A number of things, like one of the things that I think about, especially when you talk about the Black Panther Party, is how do we create success, create abilities for forward progress without being extractive of our community. And it means we go into the community and we find out what the community needs.
Yeah.
I feel like starting to see that a lot more with folks like Gang Gang or with other folks who operate in the city who are going in and asking those questions to the people who are affected and impacted by what's happening here.
Yeah.
And then can go out with their connections, with their platform, with their privilege to be able to put together the resources to answer some of these problems, to create solutions that actually work for people.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think about is that a lot of people, and this is just only what I've learned because I've had to unpack this in myself, is the ability to hold myself accountable for the ways I perpetuate white supremacy, for the ways that I have harmed not only people who don't look like me, but people who do look like me in those same ways.
Yeah.
And to be willing to be uncomfortable in that space, to know that that's where the growth happens.
Mm-hmm. Let's lean into it, bro.
How did you first recognize that within yourself?
Let's lean into it.
And how does the work you do now, you talk about it being reparative, how does that work feed into this idea of I'm holding myself accountable in order to lift up the people around me who want to do the same thing?
That's very good. So I just uncrossed my leg because it's getting serious. And my leg was falling asleep, but we have to continue to lean into our consciousness. But being dead serious, man, for me, that journey, and I may have missed the back end of that question, so correct me if I'm wrong, but love is how it happened. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Like yep. I keep saying, shout out to Black women. I learned just how traumatized and hurt I am by nature of being around people who actually love me. Because it's hard to lie to somebody that you love, Doc.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, take that back. It's hard for someone to believe a lie that actually loves you. That's what I meant to say. Because lying is easy.
Yeah.
We can do it all the time. And you can do it to anybody. People who love you and people who don't. Mm-hmm. But for the person that you're telling the lie to believe that lie, if they really love you, it's hard for them to be able to resonate with that because they feel you. And I got to shout out Black women who love me and have loved me have also played a crucial role in giving me a mirror. And I'm a very private person. I didn't know that because I have a very public personality.
Sure.
And I'm never the type to just act like I don't see you. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to shake your hand. I did that when we met today.
Yeah, 100%.
But I've learned in relationships, romantic and non-romantic, just how private of a person I am. And like, it's interesting, man. I just finished a fast, right? And the fast ended yesterday. So like 40 days, mm-hmm. basically, I went vegan for 40 days. Very intentional. There's 5 or 6 things I manifested, 5 or 6 things I was praying. Now, this all connects to your question, Doc.
For sure.
5 or 6 things I prayed on. And then for one day, I didn't eat at all. So like one day per week, I didn't eat at all for 6 weeks. And very powerful process. And I learned a lot of things I didn't expect to learn. I was affirmed on things I expected to be affirmed on. And I was able to cut off some things I knew I needed to cut off. But there's this convergence of my fast that didn't move fast at all with love that moves very, very, that's built very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. And love just really put a light on what areas of my life that I really need to grow. Because I'm constantly growing.
Yeah.
But if you're, and I know you're following me, man, because you're just very, very bright, Doc.
Like I appreciate that.
And I ain't just saying that, but I mean, I'm fascinated. You understand that when you are growing at a fast rate, that consumes time, talent, and treasure. So much, you'll just focus on the growth.
Yep.
That you don't even realize where you might be stagnant or depleting.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
But in a relationship, people will share with you. They'll see this, but they become, even if they're there just for a season, they'll become radically aware of totality. And because of their love and appreciation for you, they might not be able to communicate in a way that sounds loving, but they'll say, hey, you're doing great here, but because of what you're doing here, you're neglecting a lot here. And man, that's the beauty of partnership. Again, in a romantic and in a non-romantic context. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out who my life partner will be. You know, that is a... And that's not this podcast. And I haven't even healed enough to be able to have that kind of a conversation. But what I will say is, man, I learned, and I'm saying learned like right now, radically right now, I'm involved with conversations with people and myself and the God that I serve around saying, as God continues to bless me, I'm stewarding, right? That's how we started the interview. I'm stewarding. Mm-hmm. Doc, there are some areas of my life where I am neglecting. And it has a negative impact on my trajectory. And I have to stop allowing my only motivation to be, I can grow faster if I do this thing.
Sure.
Sometimes my motivation just needs to be the inner child in you deserves to heal from this. So make it a priority. So that's my journey to becoming more personally accountable. It happened through love, bro.
100%. I appreciate you sharing that. Like, a lot of this conversation has been about healing and how do we heal? Because when we heal ourselves, and this is a journey that I've been on, particularly through therapy over the last 9 months or so, is like healing my inner self has helped me enter into community with other people
yes,
and
sir.
Find the appropriate healing yes, and figure out I don't want to say my place, but the place that I can best serve utilizing mm-hmm. talents and gifts that I have.
Yes, sir.
And through healing, I can show up better for my partner, mm-hmm. for our new child, mm-hmm. for my family.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. For my family who we're going through stuff right now where it's just like, okay, what am I able to provide? What capacity do I have that I'm not overstepping and that I can be radically self-aware that there are places I am missing, lacking, not showing up in the way that I could because I've been so focused over here. This is literally a conversation I had in therapy today was about, you know, I am over here with what I've got going on personally, what I got going on professionally, and I've really been focused over here and there's some stuff happening over here that I'm like, eh. But now that I'm talking to you, I'm like, okay, what can I give? Because we're talking about setting boundaries. We've been talking about how do we appropriately push up against those boundaries? Can we extend them if we need? Do we need to recede them? And when it's with people you love, it can be more difficult.
Oh, yes.
Because it's like,
oh, yes.
Am I now in charge of or managing those people's feelings as well? Ooh. And I don't want to do that because it's not my responsibility to do so. But it's hard to get your mind wrapped around that because your heart's entangled in it.
And I want to give you this, right? And this is not to cut you off. This is just so good. This is so good. Always, and this is your encouragement, brother. Understand our inability to manage the this stuff with the this stuff, the growth with the deplete, the recession with the moments of it, that's what makes us human. And being a leader does not preclude you from being a human.
100%.
And again, maybe that is generally understood, but I know in my own experience, I oftentimes bumped heads with that.
Yeah.
Like my ability to be human while also leading at a very, very high level. And so I would hurt myself, never in physical ways besides not getting sleep, which is one of the worst ways to hurt yourself. I overworked, but I would literally punish myself for not being well by making myself worse until I learned, one, that is wild. And it's not wild because I'm stupid, but it's the nature of the culture, a capitalistic culture that's rooted in production, that's tied to our masculinity.
Yep.
And it's giving myself grace, which everybody's talking about. But seriously, giving yourself grace to say, you know what? If God gave me grace, I can give myself grace. But then number two, in addition to that, these flaws don't make you less human. They make you more human.
Exactly. And I think that for me, for a long time, I appreciate you saying that because for a long time, I wasn't even allowing myself to be human because I had rejected a crucial piece of my humanity. So how can I ever show up in that way if I'm not allowing myself to be at least a more whole version of myself? Because I've been over here rejecting through a number of different factors. So I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate you pointing that out. You've shouted out Black women multiple times here. Shout out Black women. I was watching your TEDx talk today.
Goodness gracious.
Two times. First off, I'm views 420 and 421. Let's run the numbers up on that thing. Because I know you just say you don't like to be called a preacher, but you're literally a teacher in this moment.
Thank you.
You're teaching.
Thank you.
History.
I appreciate that.
Black history.
I appreciate that.
And I want to bring up two things, but specifically talking about Black women, you bring up Asada Shakur.
Yeah, dude. One
of the things you said was how she lived in community with her concept of liberation. Very powerful. I'm wondering how her work guides the work you do, specifically when it comes to liberation for young Black entrepreneurs like yourself.
Man, he watched a TED Talk twice.
It's powerful.
One, you know, we talked about shame earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, man, judgment, shame, grief are very human emotions. And oftentimes we have leaders who we glorify to a point beyond judgment, shame, or grief, like they never experienced those emotions. And the story of Asada Shakur embraces all three of those and so much more. She was not perfect, and her imperfections are often put on a pedestal. Even still, I find space to revere her for those reasons. So when I think about how do I take beyond her work, but her story, her lived experience? Because sometimes, because our story is enough. Our body of work is not needed to validate the power of who we are. I shouldn't have to have the PhD and the JD and the ABC and the 123 and the A5A and
the qualifier.
Like, just by nature of ALM2, my initials, and the dots and the connection points between those initials should be without. And her story alone validates why she's someone we should be inspired to be by. And man, for me, connecting to the back half of your question, how does that inspire the work we're doing for Black entrepreneurs? One, humanity, healing, and hurt both start. All three of those things start the same way, the same letter. Humanity, healing, and hurt. And that's just like life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of things start the same way. But each of those words has such different meaning. They start with the same letter, brother. Humanity, humility, healing, hurt, all of these things start with the same freaking letter. Man, but they end so differently.
Mm.
And what I'm saying is, so independent of where you start, you still have a chance at curating community.
Mm.
Independent of where you start, you still have an opportunity to pursue purpose. Independent of where you start, you have the capacity, the capability, and the congruency to love, to grow, to develop.
Mm.
And I think that her story, her legacy, greater than her story, her legacy embodies that. It embodies that, man. And so when I think around the work that I do specifically with Black entrepreneurs, it's that.
Mm.
Independent of where you started, whether you are an Asada or an Angela, you are a Martin or a Malcolm, you are a, I don't know, I can give a whole bunch of other names. You have the space, you have the right, you have the power to make sure that the whatever letter comes next gears towards growth, towards development, towards understanding. You deserve that. And when you walk into my spaces, you get to experience liberation because it's centralized.
Mm.
It's a centralized experience. And it's an experience so centralized that no matter how you start, it can still end with curating community. It can end with something positive. It can end with something sustainable.
Man, that's a word right there. Like, I take so much, I resonate with it because for a long time, I thought I was too late to start any of this. Curating community, healing, finding growth in any way. I was just going to be this person that I always was, and I didn't know who that person was. So I was just going to be a shadow, a question mark. And learning, finding community, one, but then unlocking the piece of myself that I've locked away allowed me to realize, oh, I can start right now. There is, not only is there enough time, there's more than time to go as far as I want to go. And if I reach a point where I maybe don't want to go any farther in a particular thing, I can do that and go over here and try something else. But it's about the belief and the knowledge and truly believing that you can do those things. And you're not limited by whatever societal construct has been placed on you or around you to keep you from going in this way or to make you believe that you can't go in any other direction. Another person you referenced in the TED Talk, Dr. James Cone. You talk a lot about your faith. I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit about the influence that he has had, particularly from a theological perspective on your work.
My dog. Boy. Woo. Tell your community, podcasters, send them a one-pager, how to do research. Man, because it makes this so much better for the viewer. You skip the phlegm of it all. You just get right into it. Thank you. Dr. James Cone is the father of Black liberation theology. And that concept changed my life. Now, again, I told you, I had to work to decenter whiteness in my attempt to better understand Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy, but it's true. Shout out to Future. Shout out to Future and Metro. Hell of an album.
Ooh.
But again, Crazy But True is a song by Future. And what's crazy but true is the fact that it's a white man who told me about Black liberation theology. you know, Dr. Brent Hagee, who is a professor over at Butler. It's the only reason why I study religion. And I'm not going to give that white man credit for all of this stuff I did for black people, with black people in community, with black folks. But I got to call a spade and the truth is the truth. And taking this class on liberation theology, so the theology of liberation, I was introduced to so many different frameworks for liberation. Mm. Like, there is a framework for liberation for every sort of identity there is, and there's a theological backing to it. So it ain't just black liberation theology, but Dr. James Cone, the cross and the lynching tree, my God. The theology of black liberation, my God. I mean, it when I learned that Jesus was black like me, and not like me, not just like me, but also like Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin and Rodney King and like so many black men and black people who have been lynched physically, emotionally, and psychologically by the fire of white supremacy, hung on the trees of injustice, where we're swinging like strange fruit in the poplar trees of mass incarceration, poplar trees of a lack of understanding of purpose, poplar trees of holding up institutions whose walls are built with wood that our stores are attempting to cry through, but are silenced. Man, the way I saw myself change, because then I really started to see the God in me. I said, oh, he was walking the streets just like I was. He was tempted with it. And this is what he did in response. Now serving leadership ain't just a good thing to do. It's required to be free. So when I talk about James, that read, and I read. And you saw, I had a number of references in my TED Talk.
Yep.
Man, but that was what he did for me. But then, Doc, then I learned about people like Dr. Frederick Douglass Haynes III. I know.
Yep.
And that's why I can say it.
Yeah.
A text without context is a pretext for conning people. My oratorical mentor. Dr. James Cone opened up let me give you what Michael Jordan did for Kobe Bryant is what Dr. James Cone did for me. Like, and that's not, I mean, Kobe is, and rest in peace to the Black Mamba, rest in power to the Black Mamba. But we see that the influence of inspiration.
Yeah.
Man, that was what Dr. James Cone did for me, Doc.
Man, I appreciate you sharing that. Like I said, like, your TED Talk is real powerful. I'm disappointed in the world for only having watched it so many times, me being two of those watches already. So let's go, world. Pick it up. Figure it out.
My dog.
I appreciate this analogy of, you know, what Michael was for Kobe, yeah, Dr. James Cone was for you. That actually makes me think of a line that you share at the end of For Naptown to the World.
Bro!
Where you go, what, Morgan Freeman is a 21.
That's what I knew, 42.
Yeah. Like, that literally just made me think of that. So, and one of my questions was, you know, you even talk about, you reference not only Corey, but you reference AA. You reference whenever anybody calls you to pull up, you're going to pull up.
Who is this guy?
Indianapolis hip hop, like, we've been having that conversation a lot on this podcast recently. What is your viewpoint of the culture right now and where it's going? Like, with folks like Corey, with a whole Slum Baby family, yeah, like, yeah, they're really doing it. Like, what do you see in the work that's being produced by these young folks who you are obviously co-signing?
Yeah, yeah.
What is your viewpoint?
My biggest thing, man, is whether or not your sound is like AA or King Corey, whether it's like Maxi or Mad Dog, whether it's like, and I can keep giving a bunch of different names, or it's the Mariah Ivies or Manon Voices of the World, or it's like, it's just, I can name so many different names. My biggest thing is about the storytelling. Like, that's my biggest thing. Like, it's all about the storytelling. And from Rekindle to Paris LaDame, like, because, you know, we naming these brothers, we got to name some of these sisters, too.
Yeah.
It's just super duper important for me that we acknowledge there are so many artists, black artists specifically, who are telling their story unapologetically. Like, you know, one of the biggest critiques in hip hop is people talking about stuff they ain't actually endure.
Right.
Man, when you listen to the people, like, you know they're experiencing that. Like, that they're, and it's radically vulnerable, man.
Yeah.
I just taught a class last week at Butler to my entrepreneurial storytelling class. And I talked about the interrelationship between vulnerability, confidence, and imposter syndrome. And it's a growth, right? You go from you're confident, And then you experience this moment where you feel like an imposter because of it, oftentimes as a consequence of your confidence. And then you learn that imposter syndrome is a crisis of confidence, not competence. Mm. So as long as I stay confident, I don't have no issue with my competence. And then I feel strong enough to be vulnerable.
Mm.
And I'm seeing artists, hip hop artists, just artists generally.
Yeah.
They are going across that spectrum. They're confident enough to say, I'm going to take on this art form. I'm going to rap. I'm going to sing. I'm going to paint. I'm going to sculpt. Mm. I'm going to whatever. And then they experience the success because we're going through a renaissance. Shout out to Steven.
Yeah.
But in the midst of this renaissance, I experienced greater success at a faster pace than I was even prepared for. So now my confidence extends beyond my capacity and experience this burden. And if I don't have the right language, I'll give the fact that I'm an imposter, that's what I'll call it.
Mm.
But no, it is a crisis of confidence. So let's double down on confidence by what? Creating a boundary that's enforced by community. A community of people that say, no, you're not incompetent. We just got to increase your confidence because you're growing. And then you have the strength to be vulnerable about nothing else. If nothing else, then the fact that I was Christ, I was confident, and then I experienced a crisis. And my community helped me to engage and learn and grow through that crisis to a point where now I can tell you that everyone you revere had this issue before. So the fact that you're experiencing it does not inhibit you from being great. It's indicative of your greatness.
So that makes me think of something you talked about, you know, to kind of like full circle this conversation. You talked about at the beginning of how we've, particularly for the Black community, but really for all marginalized peoples, inherited this idea of shame, this idea of unworthiness.
Ooh.
And what you're saying here is like through community, you, like the people who have struggled and have experienced, you know, the crisis of confidence, you're not inheriting those things. You're inheriting the greatness that is inherent within the work that you do.
He said inheriting the greatness that is inherent. So again, words, right? To inherit something, typically it's bestowed upon you by nature of a decision somebody else made. But he's saying you're inheriting something that's inherent. Inherent means it's there regardless. So this concept of inheriting being bestowed, it's one thing for someone to give you something. It's another thing for you to discover it. When I first started coaching, what I always told people, I said, we're going to curate this purpose statement. I'm not going to give you anything. I'm going to help you discover what was always there. And why is that so beautiful, y'all? Because liberation is there.
Yep. Lives rent-free in our stories. I told you, I watched it twice. I'm going to go watch it again after we leave here.
Hey, this top three.
I appreciate that, man.
This top two.
Ooh, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. That might be one of the greatest compliments I've ever received doing this show.
And it's just because I can't say it's top. Just because I'm going to get in trouble on contracts. This is crazy.
I appreciate that, bro. For real. I'm looking up here. I honestly could talk to you for 4 hours. I want to keep you within the boundaries of our time to be respectful of that. Two more questions. What do you... Okay, and this is one of the things that I hate. These guys can back it up. I hate free labor.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not about that anymore.
Me neither.
I hope this doesn't seem like I'm asking you to give free labor. Sign up for his close friends.
If you're
out here looking, sign up for that to receive this knowledge, to get on game. Any words of advice for folks coming up right now that they just need to hear, that you think they should hear?
Yeah, for sure. Biggest piece of advice, the only difference between those that make it and those that didn't is that those who made it continue to show up. And even if you're too shameful to show up for somebody else, show up for yourself. Or if you're too shameful to show up for yourself, show up for somebody else. You just got to continue to show up. You are worthy of showing up. And that won't make sense now. That's why you have to be inspired. Inspiration is external. Motivation is internal. Empowerment is external. You are first inspired to be motivated and ultimately empowered. Let me be your inspiration. I'm telling you, you're worthy of showing up. If you're too shameful to show up for yourself, show up for someone else. And they're going to tell you to do what? Show up for yourself. Best advice I can give.
Show up for yourself. Last question.
Yes, sir.
How do we show up for you? How do we support you? How do we find you going forward?
Run that TED Talk up for show.
It's going to be linked in the show notes.
You know what? The best thing you can do is just listen. the thing I appreciate the most about this conversation is that you actually listen to what I've said. Because you've had all these full circle moments. If you really listen to what it is, I've been saying the same thing for 10 years. Mm. But people become more mesmerized with how I sound than what I say. Mm. And they miss the real message. Because it sounds great. But I promise, there's a message for your liberation in words I spoke 7 years ago. You just got to go and listen to it. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Murdoch, it has been an absolute privilege. It has been an honor to have this conversation with you. Folks, you can find links to everything that we talked about down here in the show notes, how to connect, how to listen. You can find it right here. Go to conversationpeacepod.com to catch up on all the latest episodes and everything else we got going on over there. Conversation Peace, the newsletter, sign up on Substack, and new episodes of the show drop every Tuesday on YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Appreciate y'all being here in 2024, the year of the nap. Shout out to Mike Lee behind the camera. Shout out to John Overton, Popular Rapture, on the mics. And man, I'm just like stumbling over this closing because I'm just so inspired by this conversation. But until next time, until the next conversation, this has been the titular Patrick and Conversation Piece. We'll see y'all soon.